Hey, got the morning show here on Raglan Community Radio, and I want to welcome Finn McAtee to the studio. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
And we're here to talk permaculture. You are a permaculturist. We're allowed to call you that.
Yep.
Because you've done the course. Is that how it works?
I don't know. I think there is debate within the community around who gets to call themselves a permaculturalist or not.
Okay.
But I think anyone who aligns with the ethics and understands, I guess, how to apply design principles.
Yeah.
Permaculture design principles is probably a permaculturalist.
Yeah. And you do this, you're doing this on your own property. You've done this as a consultant for other people.
Yep.
You've done that sort of stuff. I know you've taught, because you taught me.
Yep.
15 years ago for a weekend course.
Yep.
We were younger and less grave back then, I seem to recall. So I just wanted to give people a little bit of your background, those who don't know you.
Yep.
And today, I know we've been working through the permaculture design principles that David Holmgren put together about 20 years ago. So what are we up to at this point?
So we're on design principle 6, produce no waste. And so this is the last of that, kind of the first 6, which are really about trying to understand systems and how to apply systems thinking, I guess, when designing.
Right. Okay. Briefly, systems thinking?
So if
that's possible.
Yeah. So systems thinking or systems theory is really about just understanding the entanglement of complex systems. And so everything is integrated. So, you know, that Newtonian or Cartesian understanding of the world as black or white, or, you know, everything is divisible and separable.
Yeah.
You know, that led to huge breakthroughs in science and all the rest of it, but has led us to this worldview today, which says that, you know, I'm an isolated self and I'm separate and distinct from you and from my environment, and my environment is something out there. So all of those things have emerged through this understanding of separation, whereas systems thinking is about understanding integration, interconnectedness, interdependence, and entanglement.
So that's actually informed our value system in the modern world.
Absolutely.
And that's not come from an observation of what the world is like. It's come from the way we observed the world, and still. We call it reductionist thinking.
Yeah, that's it, reductionism.
Yeah, but it's not. Yeah, I'm just intrigued by that idea just now, that it's not come from how we what we observed, but how we observed.
That's exactly right. It was the methodology, right?
Yeah. So that's a very misleading way.
Well, it's one way of understanding the world, and it has inherent limitations.
Yeah, I mean, it has advantages too, obviously, but we need to recognize that because it's really good at what it does. It doesn't mean it can tell us about everything.
Yeah, well, in fact, it can't. It can't tell us about anything that we can't quantify, yeah. Right?
And the thing with the systems theory, in my head, the reason for it is that we can't follow every individual thing. Like, we can't track and learn about every member in our community to then work out from that how the community is going to behave. Like, it's too hard, too much detail. And then and certainly for the whole country, we can't.
Yeah, and so I guess without getting too much down the rabbit hole of systems theory is there's different types of systems, and the type of system you're talking about is what we call complex systems. And complex systems are inherently adaptive; they're emergent, so they have properties that we can't know in advance. So they're unknowable. By the nature of the complexity of the relationships, is we can think we know everything about the system, but it changes regularly. And so, and it has emergent properties, emergent qualities. So new things happen that we can't necessarily foresee or predict. We can look back and go, oh, maybe that emerged because of this or that or the other.
Yeah.
But in advance, we can't actually know. And so there's a shift. It's almost like our scientific understanding of the world. Science hasn't caught up with our scientific understanding of the world in lots of ways. And so with things like system science, we know that we can't know everything, but yet science with a capital S is still focused on trying to understand everything in the world so that we can figure out how to solve stuff.
It's a bit of an ideological position.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, like you said, it's informed by values that shape the world. And, you know, so it is a little bit of a tangent, but why this came up is we're looking from a systems. We're trying to see the whole. So if science is kind of reductionistic, you know, kind of by nature, and you know, there is science within that is more holistic. But what we're talking about now is kind of holism, that idea of trying to step back and look at the whole thing, the whole system, and understand it and interact with it as best we can, knowing that it's this really complex system and we can't know everything and we can't, we certainly can't predict everything. So there's a little bit of an art and science to this, and then we bring in design.
Did you put suggest a bit of a difference between systems theory and complex systems theory? Because I started talking about complex system.
Yes. So systems theory is just generally an understanding of there's lots in it, and complex adaptive systems are one type of system. So all living things, including, you know, their environment, are complex adaptive systems. But we have things like airplanes that are not, right? They're complicated systems. We have things...
Complicated, not complex.
That's exactly right.
Right, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So when we say things like, you know, it's not rocket science, most of the time it's much more complex than rocket science.
Yeah, right. Yeah, rocket science is complicated, not complex.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So back to...
Produce no waste.
Produce no waste. We think we know about that in Raglan and Whangaroa. We've been...
Yep.
Well, we've been on the journey to zero waste for 25 years now,
yep.
But clearly there are challenges.
Well,
is that what you wanted to talk about?
It is. I'm keen to kind of unpack the principle and how we can think about it. But I think an observation, something useful to consider, is that waste, as we know it today, and GDP or economic growth, they're complementary. They track together. There's never been any instance that I know of where GDP has increased and waste has gone down. GDP increases, waste goes up. GDP goes down, waste goes down. So they're coupled. And so in a economic growth-focused society, aspirations of zero waste are ambitious.
So, okay, let me think about this. So extreme, we have the best community recycling, we're the best community in the country at recycling. Last time I checked some stats, I'm being hand-wavy here. But what extreme's trying to do is lower the percentage so that it's still coupled with GDP and obviously with population growth, because we've had 1,000 new arrivals, or an increase of 1,000 people in the last 10 years in town. We just found that out this month. But are you going to suggest that we try to decouple waste from GDP?
Well, no, or not look necessarily.
At it, or turn it around so that waste is handled differently.
Well, that's it. So I think there's several ways of thinking about this, and we'll get into it in the principle. But or when we start, you know, unpacking this, exploring it. But it's just a general observation that the way our society relates to and understands waste is directly coupled to the way our society understands kind of health and well-being, which is, you know, cancerous. There's an element of, from a values point of view, getting back to that, is we assume that economic growth is good and that economic growth is kind of always good and good for everyone and everything, whereas, you know, we have heaps and heaps of evidence to suggest that that's not actually true. What we need is a healthy economy, but that's not about growth. And coupled with that is we just assume then that waste is necessary as a result of growth. And so they're coupled in that kind of value set.
Do we assume, or did we just not even notice?
Well, I think if you talk to people on the street, so I assume that as a society, we just kind of go, well, you know, we need waste.
Okay.
Yep. So, you know, it's a byproduct. It's a necessary evil. Or whatever you
want. Yeah, I think people would say
it.
That. Yeah, they'd say, well, we've got to... I heard the thing about oil. Well, we've got to drive.
Yeah, that's exactly
you know,
right.
And it's like, okay, whatever.
No, we need to move. Yeah. We don't need to drive.
Well, that's a good point, actually. Yeah.
And so similarly, but so as all the other principles, this one has two English whakatauki associated with it.
Yeah.
So the first one is waste not, want not. And that might be self-evident, but I guess the idea is, you know, frugality and understanding what we need and living by that leads to generally kind of equilibrium and having, you know, a healthy, stable life. Whereas the opposite of that is, you know, if we have this kind of abundance, if we don't manage abundance and there's kind of a degree of greed and waste that can come back to bite us later on.
So is that what that phrase means? Waste not, obviously, don't waste things, but want not, is that imploring us to not be greedy? And
yeah, so that's my understanding. Is like,
I've never thought about that phrase.
Yeah. So my understanding of it is, yeah, if we don't waste, then we don't have want, because we're using things efficiently and, you know, we're being frugal. And whereas, so it's interesting because our society, again, getting back to this idea of cultural values, but our economic system and therefore our marketing and all the rest of it requires us to want, right? We need to want because then we have to consume.
Well, there's basic capitalism. Then there's what we've got now where whole industries are dependent on short life cycles.
Yeah. So consumerism.
Goods, yeah, which didn't used to exist. So that's a whole other thing.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then there's this other whakatoki, which is stitch in time saves nine. And so my understanding is this is kind of like a sewing metaphor, but this speaks more to the maintenance side of the principle, produce no waste.
Fix the hole before it gets bigger.
That's exactly right. And the bigger it gets, the more time and effort and resource required to try to recover that thing, whatever it is.
Like a slightly exponential growth, perhaps, and effort required.
Yeah, that's it. So, you know, there's the adage of little and often, which is a really good strategy for maintaining, you know, your tools, for example, is, you know, tool maintenance is one example of the kind of stitch in time saves nine.
Yeah.
But then there's the more extreme, or the not extreme, the larger scale versions of that, which is, you know, the American highway network right now, and bridges in particular. You know, they're, from what I understand, at the end of life and, you know, require substantial, because they've been neglected for so long, is, you know, over the next 10, 15 years, there's going to be a whole bunch of highway infrastructure that will
This is the no story of the Western world. We haven't done that stitch in time thing. Like, that's why our Three Waters issue is so prominent at the moment, even though we got diverted by other issues that other political parties attached to it.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the problem was we're going to have to spend a whole lot of money, and no one quite knew where the money was coming from.
Well,
and that makes me wonder where the money used to come from.
Well, so I think there's several things here. One of them is the larger the infrastructure, the more energy required to maintain it, generally speaking. And so as our infrastructures got bigger, the maintenance costs have increased too.
Certainly standards keep rising.
Yeah, and then there's... Yeah, so there are several things that drive it, but basically this famous anthropologist named Joseph Tainter, he was interested in why complex societies have this very typical pattern of every kind of 600 to 800 years they seem to collapse. Why is that?
Is that the diminishing returns?
That's exactly what it is.
On
diminishing marginal returns. Okay. So it's sorry, I got this stat wrong. It's about 300 years.
Yeah.
That typical civilizations kind of rise and fall within. And he was interested in what are the processes. But that's exactly right. Diminishing marginal returns. So the more infrastructure you build, the more time, energy, resource you need to reinvest back into maintaining
that. So is that diminishing returns on complexity?
It is.
Yeah, yep.
So you could imagine, you know, and I've heard stories recently of the first grid that was provided to Raglan, and the unimaginable boon that would have been to the people living here at the time, where
electricity,
you know, yeah, you could flip a switch and that would have been awesome. And then all of a sudden, you know, you've got your eighth transformer built and, you know, your two more subdivisions on the horizon, and all this complexity becomes starts to weigh down on the system. You know, you in the community announcement you were talking about a review of all the 33 community halls within the district, And over time, all of those need maintenance. And you can imagine for a whole range of reasons, there'll be certain years or budgets where they went, oh, we'll defer that to the next time. And
one of the holes in there has been deferred to death.
Well, that's it, right?
Yeah.
And that happens just regularly. So it's almost like this cultural wisdom that, you know, often sits within rural communities, but definitely within indigenous cultures, of knowing, well, we have this proclivity to defer things and to put off the cost of maintenance, but we actually know that that's detrimental to the health and well-being of our society. So we actually need to prioritize maintaining regularly.
It's an interesting thing to try to pin down why that happened, because you could say, well, we went into this neoliberal economic model 40 years ago, and that's diverted money from the lower levels to the higher levels quite successfully, and so our rates are less effective. Or you might say it's that thing of increasing complexity at 50, 80 years ago, when you invested in something in your community, it made a big difference.
Yep.
And it was really easy, and so we got used to raising standards.
Yep.
And now we have we have a sewage system. There's a new sewage processing plant being built here at the moment, which is going to produce water that would basically be drinkable.
Yep.
At the end of it. So it's really, really fantastic at processing the sewage. It's going to cost. It is costing a lot of money. It's a really high standard. That's going
to
require
to build.
Yes, and to maintain.
That's right.
Because it's a machine rather than probably does use some natural processes, but not a lot.
Yeah.
From what I understand, so it's state of the art. It's high tech.
Yep.
It does a great job.
Yep.
If we try to raise that standard again, I don't know how we're going to afford it, and that comes back to the Three Waters thing not being afforded, and people are pointing their fingers at all sorts of different reasons why we can't afford that anymore. But from what you're saying, it might just be this diminishing returns thing.
Well, I think there's another element. I think there's lots of different ways to look at this. And so, again, we're having a systems conversation, right?
Yeah,
isn't one, you know, sometimes there is. Sometimes you can point a finger and say that's it. But most of the time, there are several systems drivers that kind of all impact on the system. And I think there's a psychological
one. You wouldn't be a very good politician.
No.
There's several systems drivers, folks. And people.
Well, not
someone
only
else
that,
is just, like, it's them.
Just a clear platform. Yeah. I'm not. Yeah, that's not how I think.
No, sorry, I've completely interrupted.
No, that's okay.
Psychological.
Oh, so there's a psychological component, which is humans are kind of, I don't like the word wired because we're not machines, but have a predisposition to value the present over the future. And maintenance is a future prioritizing, right? We know that we need to spend time now to invest in maintaining something that's going to continue to serve us into the future. So there's this individual and collective orientation towards the immediate. And so, again, I think through cultural wisdom, our ancestors knew to the value of investing in the future. And so they did that in a whole range of different ways, right? And, you know, maintaining tools, maintaining assets, maintaining infrastructure is all part of that.
And certainly, culturally, our leadership is, especially corporate leadership, has become all about, it's only about the bottom line.
Yeah.
And there's actually, I read an article the other day by a guy called Cory Doctorow about this. I'd always thought and I'd heard that there was actually a law in the US that the CEO of a corporation had to maximize profit at all times. And he was pointing out that this is not the case.
Yeah.
And that in actual fact, there's all sorts of arguments you could produce. You know, if you're spending money on something, you say, well, this is an investment for the future and it's going to maximize profits. Or if you're cutting, you could cut the same thing and say, we're maximizing profits by cutting this. So he said the whole thing is a lot more hand-wavy and not really true.
Yep.
But everyone believes it is so, and it's become a cultural value, especially in financial areas. And that I see that producing a value system where you're much more short-term thinking as well.
Yeah.
And those leaders used to, you know, if you go back far enough, corporate leaders used to have a bit of an eye on, care about the rest of the country.
Yeah, well, they knew that the health of their...
It's not considered the thing to do anymore.
Yeah. And I think there is something there about shareholders too and their role in and influence, you know.
Yeah, because the shareholders will sue you, apparently, if you do something that doesn't maximize profit. But again, you can prove all sorts of things will or won't maximize profit depending on the angle you look at it.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, what I think you're highlighting for me anyway is we need to redefine profit and what that means, you know. Yeah,
good point.
Like,
yes.
Are we talking about societal health and well-being?
Well, or this, like we're talking about waste. What's the value again? Not the value, the...
Stitch in Time Saves Nine?
No, the headline.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Produce No Waste.
Produce No Waste.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you think about profit in that terms, in terms of, well, you try and combine them.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think it is definitely related. And even from the sense of, how do you... This isn't the track that I thought we were going to go down, but how do you reinvest profits, you know, back into, so produce no waste, because, you know, zeros and ones on screens aren't very useful in recession or inflationary times, right? They just kind of, said more generally is of all the seven forms of capital, at least that, you know, I relate to and understand, is financial capital is probably the most vulnerable because it can inflate away very quickly. And so one would say that there's a risk there in turbulent economic times of not investing financial capital into other more durable forms of capital. You know, so for example, like into infrastructure, into the natural environment, into people, into community and culture, etc.
Yeah. Shall we try to get back to what you were planning to talk about?
Yeah. Yep. So this principle brings together traditional values of frugality and care for material goods, the mainstream concern about pollution, and also the more radical perspective that sees waste as resources and opportunities.
Mm.
And so, you know, we did talk about the tendency to discount the future and to, you know, our orientation towards the present over the future. But it is worth noting, too, that there are locals who have had that vision, that long-term vision about how this idea of produce no waste, maybe not framed quite that way, but could enrich the community. So you shared with me before Eva Rickard's story about the old school art center.
The old Raglan County Council was going to knock the old school down because it was in a very bad state.
Yeah, and so that was an opportunity. Yeah. And she identified it as an opportunity.
Yes, for them it was a thing to get rid of and tidy up. But Fire Eva was like, oh, this could be an art center.
Mm.
Yeah, and of course she had the mana
at
the time to go and start using it. No one really could stop her.
Yeah, unstoppable.
Which is fantastic. Yeah,
and then when we think about an extreme... similarly is that was, someone had the vision to go, wait a minute, why is all this money, not someone's, and, you know, we know who they are, but...
I can give you the story.
Yeah, go on.
Well...
It is good. I think it's so good for
story,
us to hear the
story. Actually starts with Eva Rickard again.
Pointing Rick up the hill?
Yeah, well, Rick went to talk to her and said he was concerned about the quality of the water in the harbour and the fishing
go
and things like
out
that.
The tip.
And she said, yeah, you got to sort out the tip then.
Yeah.
And then a guy came to town who was employed by the government he was like, for a year and a half, he was like a traveling salesman around the country for zero waste initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
And so he held a meeting here in the town hall and a bunch of people turned up and there was a lot of enthusiasm generated from that. And from that, the core group of people who started Extreme came together. A few others did too and they kind of fell away, but there was six or seven that were absolutely key who formed it at the start. So there was, and they were, Jerry Gillespie was the guy's name. He's an Australian guy. And I everyone I talked to when made my film about Extreme, they all mentioned his name.
Mm.
So he kind of inspired them. And he had phrases like, we say we throw something away. He'd say, well, where is away? Mm.
That's it.
Yeah. Where is away? And for some of them, that was the
first
time they heard
that. He was a systems thinker.
Yeah. And they were just like, whoa. And there were other people... There were a couple of other places around the country that had already started some community recycle centres, so they went and visited them. So it was a build. It was a building of a coming together of things and a building of knowledge.
And I think for me, one of the key things is that identification of waste as an opportunity. You know, those people went, "Hey, wait a minute. There's another way of doing this that actually can again enrich this community, can be provide this long term benefits." For all of Whangaroa, and
when from a purely economic point of view, it makes sense because there used to be one person on the gate up there part time. Now there's 40 staff. And as PJ, one of the founders, said, we were burying jobs.
Mm. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. And so, and again, there's all the other forms of capital that come out of this. You know, there's human capital. People have learned a whole bunch of different qualifications and skills, who have, you know, found local work that might not have otherwise been able to.
Mm.
There's the community capital that gets built through that. There's the reuse of all of that, those built forms of capital, all the built capital that's already,
yes,
that otherwise would have been buried,
yeah,
has now been turned into, you know, another life. I love going up there because I can see, you know, and talking to mates and bumping into people, how many future memories have been created from just the processing and the reusing of those materials. You know, the amount of times people have said, oh, I'm going to take this and go turn it into something else. You know, often, you know, kids projects or, you know, mud kitchens and playgrounds and nature play and any number of things that people use, materials that they can find up at Extreme to bring back into their kind of immediate living environment.
Yeah.
Not to mention, you know, the number of household appliances that people bring home and fix and, you know, yeah. So, I mean, there's countless examples, right, of
yeah,
all of that.
And the thing we were talking about just before we came on the air, like the really key thing to the phrase zero waste is that it's not about making things and so carefully and so well that there's no waste, because that's pretty, it seems to be impossible. It's about redefining what waste is and redefining it as a resource, which is why we shouldn't call it the dump. We must call it the recycle, not only the recovery.
Yeah, resource recovery center.
Resource recovery center is
that's
really
what it is.
It's what it is. Yeah. It's not even a recycle center.
Yeah,
it's a resource recovery center in reality.
It is.
Yeah,
yep, that's it. And but again, it's interesting. This, you know, this has come up over and over in this conversation, is how cultural values and the how becomes more important than the what. Because if we relate to it as a tip or a dump, then typically that's how we treat it. Right. And so, and it was, that's what it was. And that's how it was used.
It was in an awful state.
Yeah.
Because there often wasn't someone on the gate. And so people from Hamilton would come out and deposit,
yeah,
a drop off toxic waste that they weren't allowed, that was illegal to dump.
Mm.
So yeah, it really was in a bad state.
And so again, there's all these externalities, right? So there was the environmental impacts that that had, both on the spring that was up there and the immediate ecosystem. But then, as we know, down on the harbor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm often reluctant to quote Bill Mollison, but there is a time and place. And so when we're talking about waste and, you know, and pollution, he had this description: a pollutant is an output from any system component that is not being used productively by any other component of the system.
Mm.
And so, well, I have an issue with the concept of component. That's not how living systems work. There's,
yeah,
there's elements within the system. Is, you know, I think that's quite good, is this redefining waste as something unused. And so again, it changes our thinking about when, you know, produce no waste. Well, how do we use this in our day-to-day?
Yeah.
Well, we start designing out the concept of waste and thinking about resources and opportunities. And, you know, we can extrapolate this out to human health and well-being and ecological health and well-being as well. So one of the things that I notice is, you know, Raglan being the kind of town that it is, and with the house prices, real estate prices, et cetera, there is this tendency of locals, you know, finding it increasingly hard to stay.
Mm.
And you could argue that that's a form of waste. You know, it's a human waste. And then more broadly, we can think of things like human illness, disease, social ails. All of those are forms of waste, right? Like things like addiction, mental health.
Yeah.
All of those are, you know, they're real conditions and they're real for people, but they impact on individuals and the larger system's ability to kind of thrive and prosper.
They certainly do talk about addictions like that.
Yeah.
A waste of a human being. Sometimes people will use it that bluntly.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And so how do we, again, invest in people in a way that tries to optimize health and well-being? And so, again, that's one form of, you know, produce no waste. Because, you know, I don't know the statistics lately, but, you know, I certainly know the trend of Ministry of Health budgets are, you know, kind of on the exponential rise. You know, there's a wave of health pandemics on the horizon, and I'm not talking COVID style, but more the known ones, you know, around cardiovascular, obesity, diabetes. You know, we kind of see the trend and we know where that's heading. Mm. And that's all an incredible form of waste. You know, all that financial capital that could have been spent on a whole range of other things is having to go into ambulance at the bottom of the cliff healthcare services.
So our GDP measure doesn't register that, though.
Well, it does register it, but not as a, it registers it as a good, right?
So yeah.
Crime, incarceration,
doesn't matter.
Healthcare budgets, money all of that.
Money was spent so the GDP grew.
That's right. Yeah. So it does measure all of that, but it's assumed to be a good thing, right? So because everyone wants more GDP.
Yeah, that's just an appalling measuring device.
Yeah, and again, you know, we could have that conversation, but it was never designed to do what it does today, and the person who designed it went, please don't use it this way. So again, it has become a misused tool, essentially.
It's easier in the media, it's easy to put GDP.
Well, it's what everyone uses because we don't have another metric. You know, we don't have a genuine progress indicator or
Has someone tried to do like a happiness indicator?
Well, Bhutan has. Bhutan's created a happiness, I think it's called the Gross Happiness Index.
They're a country that's long been suspicious of the shiny bright objects coming from the modern Western world.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they are geographically isolated, have a small population, and have a long entrenched and very deeply grounded, from what I understand, religious practice.
Not much waste in Bhutan?
Well, I imagine things like microplastics and single-use plastics, like everywhere else, have kind of got through. But I don't know. Yeah, I imagine they're in a better state to be able to manage those kind of inputs in some ways.
Yeah. So we keep talking about going to big picture stuff.
Yep.
Are you able to bring this back to the personal? Or?
Yeah, well, I think so. When we're talking about producing no waste and that idea of human health and well-being, just really simple things like getting enough rest and nutrition, you know, is a really simple way of applying this principle to reduce the likelihood of illness and disease. And, you know, and for me, I know with my family, is even things like rest and nutrition helps with nervous systems, our family nervous systems, you know.
If you get enough sleep, you're not a grumpy dad. This is where
totally.
We're going.
Yeah. Well, there's an element of that, yeah.
Yeah.
And also like high cortisol levels. So, you know, chronic stress, chronic adrenal, producing adrenaline leads to adrenal fatigue and then less coping abilities to, you know, clear decision thinking. It just impacts on so many other things. So there's really simple stuff like that in terms of how do we look after ourselves and each other. And sometimes it's easier to say than do, especially when we have, you know, inflationary pressures. There's more, it's harder to put good food on the table. You know, there's all these things that can impact on this. But in principle is, one of the things I think we know from, even from an ecological point of view, is spending the time and energy to look after ourselves and our loved ones increases our quality of life, and therefore, you know, it's profit maximizing from a different kind of context.
So I want to go back to big picture again. If the parents are well, and then the family is well, then the children are raised well, and the adults we produce for the next generation are, I don't want to say better quality of adult because that makes them sound like a product.
Well, we have a healthier population.
More functional.
We do.
Yeah, we want to produce, we want to raise functional adults in the next generation.
Yep.
And that's a hugely powerful investment.
Yep.
Yeah.
And again, you can think of the waste associated with the flip side of that is, you know, what happens if you have a societal population, a cohort that isn't very functional, as you say, is, you know, that leads a society to potential breaking point, you know, where it can't cope with so much change or that level of burden to carry it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we think about from an ecological point of view, it's the same thing. We know, you know, we have a whole bunch of broken ecosystems and, you know, our water quality is degrading. Well, why is that? There's, again, several reasons for that. But the fact that we only have 1% of our national wetlands left starts to paint that picture, you know. So we need to be investing in our life support systems, in healthy ecosystems to be able to then provide that ongoing health and well-being, you know, all the what we now call ecosystem services.
Yeah, and I know this really don't want to get into politics, but we know that there's a strain of politics that points the finger at people who are struggling and puts the blame on them.
Yeah.
But if we're thinking big picture like this and this concept of what you do with waste or what is waste, we would just, if we were unemotive about it, we would see them maybe just as a human resource that's not been, I mean, that's still kind of a slightly ruthless way of looking at people, but those human resources are not in good shape, and for our society's sake, we should get them into shape.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess if we're thinking about the health and well-being of future society, we do need to invest, and we need to invest in people, we need to invest in infrastructure, we need to do all of that. But and this comes back to the second part, or maybe the first part of this principle, which is, but because we're spending so much of our time and money on new and shiny,
yeah,
we're reducing our ability to invest in a lot of other things. We're increasing the cost of maintaining what we do have for future generations, and we're producing a whole bunch of future problems in the form of waste, because a lot of the stuff that we prioritize now on a day-to-day basis, you know, our consumer habits, create current and future problems.
Mm. Was there any more on the personal level, but just before we wrap up?
So I guess this idea of refuse is actually, I think, really quite important. So,
you know, not refuse.
Not refuse,
which
but
is just rubbish.
I guess we could, yes.
Yeah.
I like that pun, though. That's quite good. So when we're thinking about on the waste hierarchy,
yeah,
you know, refuse should be at the top of that list, right?
Yeah.
And particularly in our global consumer society.
Don't buy it.
Don't buy it. And so, again, this is like a personal and final kind of action. So we decide not to engage in the consuming action or task in the first place because it's not necessary. So this comes back to that waste not, want not, is, you know, redefining want, I think, is a really important thing to do at a range of different scales. And so I guess something I've been exploring in my own life is this concept of enoughness. You know, what does enough look like? And so it does require an evaluation or reevaluation of needs. And, you know, like this is a big thing with, as I've educated my kids, is having them distinguish between wants and needs. Mm. You know, I need that ice block. No, no, you want that ice block. And, you know, and it starts from really simple things like that. But, you know, I'd imagine there's lots of things that we identify at an individual, potentially family and community level as needs that are probably wants, really.
Mm.
And so there's something kind of, I think, radical in that, but also there's a recognition that to refuse stuff often requires, you know, some prior knowledge and skills to be able to replace.
It's bad for GDP, though.
It is bad for GDP, but lots of things are bad for GDP. And lots of things.
I just thought that's ironic, and speaks to what you're saying before about GDP being a horrible measure of how things are going.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I guess just to wrap that up is that idea of, you know, replace. So that's again on the waste hierarchy. After refusing, you know, we refuse, but replacing. And we need some knowledge and skills to be able to replace. So, for example, if I'm good enough with a sewing machine, I can significantly reduce my reliance on fast fashion to provide that sense of, I guess, wearable identity. So, you know, if that's part of it. But then also, I don't need to buy new clothes because I can fix the ones I have, or at least I can fix them for a lot longer.
Yeah.
There's, you know, everything from tools, electronics, you know, that kind of creative repurposing is again, something that sits very much in that personal realm. And again, there's lots of really skilled people within this community who are great. And then we've got the Repair Cafe. You know, there's all kinds of opportunities. But there's a few things the R's on the waste hierarchy that if we really targeted, like refusing, like repairing and replacing and reusing, then again, this idea of waste takes on a whole different meaning.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Finn. Thanks for coming in.
We could go on for hours.
Oh, no doubt. Yes. Yeah.
Thanks again.
We could. All right.